Hi, this is the Dark Tangent. And the speeches you're about to listen to were recorded at DEF CON 6, which was held in July 31st to August 2nd, 1998, at the Plaza Hotel and Casino in Old Downtown Las Vegas. These speeches are copyright, non-commercial use, educational uses only. If you'd like to use them for any other purpose, please contact DEF CON at www.defcon.org or email to dtangent, that's D-T-A-N-G-E-N-T, at defcon.org. Now, some of the speeches were lost, so you're getting what we've got recorded. Now sit back and relax, and here comes some knowledge to your head.
Okay, with that, I want to hand the microphone over to Paul and get started. Oh, and Paul was very gracious. He came at the last minute, totally unexpected. He's flying in, he's flying out right after this talk. So let's give him a round of applause for zooming in just for us.
So the project I'm going to be talking about here is one that we did in combination with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and a hardware company called AWT. I'll talk a little bit more about sort of how this project happened. But the DES data encryption standard is what really everybody who has got important data, mostly commercial data, uses to protect their information. It's got a system that's older than about 4 years. It's the most widely used encryption algorithm in the world, with the possible exception of RC4, which is in most web browsers. But it's a very widely used standard. You'll find it in just about any sort of banking application. The security is very important both from the perspective of somebody who's trying to build a system and somebody who's trying to use it. This machine that we built does sort of the most obvious attack against this algorithm. It's an attack which people have been theorizing about ever since DES was first developed in the 1970s. DES is a 56-bit key. That means there are 256 possible keys. And if you could try every possible one until you found the one that correctly decrypts the message that you're interested in, you'll break DES. The reason that nobody's built a machine to do that before is that there are 72 million, billion keys, or trillion, trillion, I always get it wrong. Quadrillion keys, whatever that is. It's a huge number. And the number will show up on the slide in just a minute. And the purpose of this machine was to show that using custom hardware, it really is very straightforward to go through and make something that can search even a key space this large. If you're, I'll talk more about the machine parameters as I go forward here. I'm going to try to go a little quickly since Jeff was very nice to squeeze me in here, but I know that there are other speakers that should be shifted around. You probably heard of me from some of the other work I've done with cryptography, things like timing attacks or work on smart cards. I will not be talking about those today, although there's interesting information about them on our webpage. We're sort of a more corporate than... Okay. We're a little more corporate than Dead Cow, to put it mildly. We do a lot of work for banking and financial corporations, but also do a lot of basic research. But we tend to err on sort of the respectable side rather than the... our objective is really to make good cryptography available, because if you want to have privacy, if you want to make it so that people aren't watching what you're doing, if you want to be able to protect your information against whoever it is that's looking at it, whether it's somebody doing it for criminal purposes or because you have political opinions that are unpopular or whatever the reason, cryptography is the only way to make sure that nobody is going to be watching your information, which is one of the things that's unusual about DES, I really want to stress this, is that brute force is the easiest attack that we know of against this algorithm. Linear encryption analysis is, in some ways, a practical attack against DES, but brute force is really what you would do if you're somebody like the National Security Agency. If you go off and build your own cipher from scratch and you don't know anything about cipher design, it's very easy to make a cipher with a great big key, which you wouldn't be able to break with brute force. But where there are other easier attacks. So DES is a very well-designed algorithm, except that it was designed with this sort of inherent weakness, but it's an obvious weakness as opposed to sort of a hidden one. So there are a total of 72 million billion keys, give or take a few. And to give you some idea of this number, if you were able to search a billion per second, it would still take you 32 years to go through this key space. So it's a very big searching problem to find the right key if you're trying to build a machine like the one that we did. There are a lot of approaches that have been talked about. There are probably a dozen papers in the academic literature proposing different ways of attacking this. There are some that are software-based, which is nice because you can use ordinary existing computers, and distributed.NET is a beautiful example of that. They were actually almost approaching our speed at the end of the DES challenge that RSA issued recently, using a huge, huge number of computers. That type of attack is interesting, but in some ways it's actually made people think that breaking DES is very difficult, saying that these thousands and thousands and thousands of computers all working simultaneously, you know, that's extraordinarily difficult to organize. You can do it if you have the internet and somebody working to make this happen, but you can't break a significant number of messages that way. Several designs using FPGAs, which are sort of like programmable chips. You can customize the logic gates in the chip and make it do whatever you want, have been proposed, but again, those are off the stage here. They give you some algorithm independence, so you can build your hardware and use it for attacking different types of things. They're unfortunately much too expensive to be practical when you're working on the kind of budget that we were working on in this project. And the third sort of general category is to do a custom ASIC, which is very fast, but the initial cost for making a chip, especially if you're not careful, can be very high. We, for this particular project, used a low-run, inexpensive chip fab, which brought that NRE way down, but that's the reason that people have avoided ASIC designs in some cases. The design that we made is fairly flexible. It lets you, for example, if you know that a message is just made of human-readable ASCII text, you can configure the machine to break it with only that information, or if you know just a few bytes of the message, you can break it using that, or if you have even just other sorts of partial information about which byte values can appear or not appear in the message, it can break those. The design is just a massively parallel computer, and I'll describe the architecture of it in just a minute. One of the nice attributes of it is it's extraordinarily fault tolerant. You've got a huge number of chips that are performing similar sorts of search operations. If one of those fails, you don't want your whole search to fail. And the way the machine is designed, you can have flaws in the chip, you can have communication errors, you can have chips that just don't work. All of that's okay, and the system will keep on functioning. That's very important if you're using cheap, low-grade hardware and you don't want to worry about having the machine come down because something goes wrong in it. It's easy to use, and it's obviously fast enough to search through the heat phase in just a few days. The chips were designed in VHDL, which is sort of a C-like language that you can design a chip in. You can compile it. There are debuggers for it. It's sort of the chip designer's equivalent of a high-level language. It makes chip design very easy. It's not the most efficient way to pack as much as possible into a chip, but when you're working on a budget of $250,000 for a complete project, you don't want to be wiring individual gates together because you'll just never get it done. Each chip that we make runs at 40 megahertz. That's a fairly comfortable speed for a chip these days. If you go to an ordinary fab, they can do this. Each chip contains 24 DES units, which do one round of the DES algorithm per clock cycle. To do a complete DES function, you need 16 rounds. And this means that we can do 60 million keys per second per chip. So the little chip on my badge here can check 60 million keys in a second, which is about the equivalent of maybe 60 PCs running full speed trying to search the sort of a key space. There's no overhead between the DES operations unless the with one little asterisk that I'll describe later, but it ends up being much less than, far less than a percent of overhead. The complete machine was built out of 27 boards. I forgot to bring a board with me, I actually meant to, but they're VME bus boards with a design that's sort of standard and easy to get boxes with power supplies already configured. Each of these 27 boards has 64 of these custom ASICs soldered onto it, which are connected through a sort of a simple bus. The complete system had 37,050 working DES search units. Each of these is an independent DES function running at 40 megahertz. Of these ASICs, some of them were defective, and so those were not being used in the search. The PC that controls the system does diagnostics on the search units and just skips the bad one. Very straightforward, easy to do, and it means that you don't get bad data at your searches. The complete system checks almost 10 billion keys per second, and that's over a trillion S lookups per second. So if you're familiar with the DES algorithm, the basic sort of function that does the avalanche characteristic and the S-boxes, that's a pretty big number. It's not extraordinarily large, but it's enough that we can search through this entire key space of that many keys in an average of just under 9 days. Now, if you're searching for the right key, on average you'll find it halfway through your search, which would be an average of about 4.3 days per key using this machine. With the RSA challenge that was issued a couple of weeks ago, we got a little bit lucky and we found it about a quarter of the way through. Sometimes you might be unlucky and not find it until the last 10%. But by the time you've searched the entire key space, you should have found your key unless you typed in the messaging correctly. The entire system is a bunch of boards connected by a very simple bus that more or less lets the PC read and write registers in the chips. And there's a host PC which embarrassingly enough supports either Windows and not so embarrassingly supports Linux that controls this bus. We actually had that PC hooked up to the internet. EFF arranged a Metricom link to it, which was kind of nice so we could watch it running and give it searches so that I actually had to go into the room where it was. The PC sits there and pulls each of these 30,000 search units. And if the search unit has found a key which is either correct or might well be correct, it stops and waits for the PC to pull the key out. The speed of the system is exactly proportional to the number of chips that you put in it. So if you add a board to it, the host PC will tend to discuss this new board there, and the system will now search more keys per second. If things, for example, fail because you had some flaws in a chip that overheated or whatever, the speed would go down a little bit. And the diagnostics here detect the errors. There have been some, there was a memo that allegedly originated in the NSA describing how incredibly difficult it was to do problems like this. There's a memo that apparently went out to Congress talking about things like the number of interconnections between the devices being a problem and failures being a problem. And one of the reasons for actually building this system is to show that that's completely wrong. It's not a problem to have failures in your system. It's not a communication bandwidth problem. You can have as many of these things as you want hooked together, because all that's going over your bus is the keys that are either right or likely to be right. And that's just a matter of, if you know a plain text cipher-deck pair, it'll just be the right key. If you've got a slightly more generic search, it'll be hundreds of keys, so it's not an issue. The chip itself is designed to do sort of a sieving type problem. There's a huge number of keys, and the chip is designed to reduce the number of possible keys that the PC has to look out to a very small or at least a manageable number. The goal is to make the chip flexible enough to do as many types of searches as possible. And by letting the PC sort of sort between a few sets of false positive keys the chips turn up, it's possible to get more flexibility in the search. So the chips include a pair of ciphertexts and something called a plain text vector, which specifies which byte can appear in plain text. So if you decrypt both of these ciphertexts, and if the bytes in both of those decrypted ciphertexts have the corresponding bit set in the plain text vector, that's considered to be a good key. This is a little bit non-intuitive a way to do it, because you could just match what you expect your message to be. But by doing it, we can say, for example, that we can set just the bits in this plain text vector corresponding to ASCII text, and if both of these messages decrypt to ASCII text, then that search unit will halt until the PC pulls the key off. If you configure your search so that the fraction of keys that will halt is small enough that the PC is not going to get overloaded and the bus won't get overloaded, you'll be able to find your right key. There are two ciphertexts in there, but the second one is only checked if the first one appears valid. So having the second one doesn't slow down the performance at all, except in the case where the first one matches, and that's such a small fraction that the performance penalty is negligible. And I just sort of ran through this slide, since I'm going quickly, I really won't describe it. There's also support for a bunch of other things like CVC chaining if you use that, or output feedback mode, or It's also set up so consultant that plays a dead challenge, a bunch of things like that. It's a fairly flexible machine, so really no matter what your dead application is, there's an awfully good chance that this will be able to break your keys if you were using this machine. The machine was built sort of as a project jointly between myself, Josh Jaffe, and Ben John at Cryptography Research. We're a consulting company up in San Francisco that does fun projects all day long. A company called Advanced Wireless Technologies, which specializes in chip design. When we've done chip design projects, we usually work with them. And the EFF arranged the financing and did all the PR for the machine. Between AWT and us, we did sort of the cryptography and the architecture related to the implementation of VHDL, the board design, arranged for the manufacturing assembly and that sort of thing. The reason for building the machine isn't necessarily, doesn't make sense to some people, because, you know, why spend $250,000, which is what the machine costs, to win a $10,000 prize from RSA? But there are actually a lot of very important reasons to do this sort of thing. One is to validate the academic claims that were published before that breaking DIS was fairly easy. There were estimates of machines that could be built for about $1 million or $5 million that could break DIS in this kind of speed that were published a few years ago. There's been a lot of criticism of those papers as not taking into account things that needed to be taken into account. This also highlights the danger in short key lengths. 56 bits is not enough. And 40 bits is what people in the government want. People want American corporations who are using exportable products and foreigners to use. This machine could search a 40-bit key space in about 6 seconds on average. So if your security requirements are that your message is not important after about 6 seconds, 40-bit cryptography might be okay. Unfortunately, the round-trip latency in some TCP/IP connections exceeds 6 seconds, so this really is not a very useful level of security. And this is not a terribly fast machine. We were the National Security Agency with a budget of $10 million. Well, it probably takes them a lot more money than we coughed up. But if we were to spend twice as much money in this machine, I would estimate that we'd get at least four times the performance, perhaps even more than that. And I think that's pretty much something that will scale like that. So for every time you double the amount of money, four times the performance, you'll do more optimization, you'll get more hardware for it. Of the $250,000 we spent, about half went to the guys that did the hardware. They were actually doing this, you know, for pay, the normal project. We donated our time to the design work. This also refutes a bunch of the government's claims. Provides information to the users of DES. There are a lot of companies, financial institutions, critical infrastructure, which is protected with DES. There are standards bodies that are still rolling out single DES-based standards, seemingly oblivious to the academic work that's going on. This has got to change if we want to get anywhere, and we've got to get stronger encryption. And the last thing here is to really demonstrate what attackers already know. There's absolutely no question that governments have built these machines. If they didn't, they would have been completely irresponsible. Because, I mean, the National Security Agency's job is to listen to stuff, and people use DES to protect their traffic, so they have to be able to decrypt it. And the last thing, it's a fun project. There's just, you know, breaking DES is about as interesting a crypto project as you can do. I'm going to take a few questions now. I imagine there are going to be a bunch. I'm not quite sure how I am on time here. Okay. Yeah?
You said that the way it works as far as recognizing what the right answer is, that either what is decrypted in the half key range.
You can configure it to do that. You can set which bytes can appear in the message, and if different bytes other than the ones that are considered good have appeared, then the key is rejected. I think in the RSA search we set just the bits that we knew appeared at the beginning of the message. We've run a couple of different searches on that. Once you found a false positive, a key which passes those criteria, the host PC is controlling the system, then goes ahead and does whatever additional tests you want. That PC runs configurable software, so you can't change the chip. So we made the chip as flexible as possible, and you customize the PC to the specific problem you've got. Yeah? The design was probably about 2 or 3 weeks of work. We already had a VHDL DES core that was optimized for a different project, so the DES function itself didn't require any work here. The information describing how the system is built, all the design documents, the VHDL source code is all available in book form in nice OCRable format. If you'd like to get a copy of it, it's available on the PFF webpage with a link to the people that sell it. I don't actually remember where you go to buy it. I don't know. Does O'Reilly's website sell direct? Okay. I'm not actually sure if this is available online anywhere yet. It is?
Yeah, I got it from O'Reilly's site. They're on the third
printing. Is the content of the book been scanned?
I got it at Liberty to divulge that information.
Okay. The purpose of publishing it is really, from my point of view, to make sure that people believe that what we've done works. I mean, there's not really any question about it. You can go and see the machine. But there's been so much misinformation about this that it was really important to get these results published and distributed as widely as possible. Yeah? We're not... AWT, I think, might actually sell people machines. If you want to buy one, give them a call. It's legal to make these things in the U.S. as far as I know. Yeah? You email John Gilmore and ask... I don't think it is. One of the things is this machine runs fairly hot. Each chip takes a couple of watts of power, and 3,000 watts sitting in a small room doesn't meet some of the OSHA regulations, I think. I mean, it's really kind of makes a halogen lamp look very efficient. So I don't think it's going to be. It's not something that's nice to leave up to 7x24 unless you've got a big air conditioner, and we don't right now. Yeah. Something I'd like to encourage everybody here is there's a lot more sort of talk than action in cryptography in general. The academic work you could classify as talk, but it's very important to have that going on. But there isn't a lot of good applied research being done. This project, some of the stuff we've been doing with differential power analysis, work I've been doing with timing attacks, work we've been doing on threat modeling. I mean, this is just new territory trying to figure out how to actually use cryptography and make things actually secure with it. People aren't doing that much. I would encourage everybody here to get books like Bruce Schneier's book, Applied Cryptography. If you're more mathematical, Handbook of Applied Cryptography is more rigorous and more complete, but it's not quite as friendly to approach. You know, learn about this, play around with it, implement things, break other people's ciphers. There are not a lot of bad ones out there. It's very, very rare that we do a security review that says a whole lot of things that are positive about a product, and most of them, you know, we'll just extract the keys out in a matter of a few days. So it's really an area where you can have an awful lot of fun. I think the hardware was somewhere around $80,000-$90,000 to get the ASICs manufactured, and that included about 1,800 of them. We got a little bit of a discount because the fab that did these things had some problems testing, so they didn't test any of the chips. We just soldered them all up because the system is so fault tolerant and having a bunch of bad chips in there is fine. So if you were to actually go and do it again, you'd probably spend a little bit more. But ballpark, $100,000.
That's the first question.
Well, if you have zero information about what a ciphertext decrypts to, you have no way of identifying which is the right key. So you have to have some information in order to separate correct plain text from false ones. And in this case, you have to have essentially 56 bits worth of information about a pair of ciphertext in order to be able to make the search work. I can't think of ever running into an application where you wouldn't have that type of information. So in practice, you've normally got checksums, you've got messages you know are text, you've got control headers that are encrypted, so it's not generally an issue. Yeah.
How large is the vector? Can you need the beginning of the method or
the second vector?
How large is the bit vector? You need the first 56 bytes for the method, so any
bytes for the method. This machine works by doing decryption operations. So in order to make this work, you have to have a complete ciphertext that was produced by the DES algorithm. So that would be a 64-bit chunk that was produced as the output of DES. That's available, and that's what the DES standards say that you're supposed to be outputting. So that's kind of the normal thing to have available. if you only had a portion of that, the machine would not work with that. Yes?
I have a question about scalability. If you made it twice as big, would you have done it twice as fast?
Yes. You can make the number of chips that you've got is the number of TV searches per second is proportional to the number of chips. So if you've got one chip hooked up to one board, you get 60 million keys per second. If you've got 10 chips, you get 600 million, 100 chips. You know, it just goes up like that. Yeah?
How does this affect other algorithms, like triple dead and stuff?
Well, there's sort of a lot of different things that get said about key space. And this is the question that Bruce got earlier and sort of said I'd answer. In the case, whenever you add a single bit to the length of a key, the effort required for brute force doubles. So if you have a 57-bit key, it'll be twice as hard. 58 is twice as hard again. Once you get around 80 bits, it becomes really impractical even the sort of budget that we'd be able to scrounge up today. On the counter side to that, though, Moore's Law knocks off at least a bit every year. Computers get faster, and because this is such a parallelizable problem, you don't need single computer microprocessors that run fast. You can use parallelism. In addition to that, there are attacks that involve birthday paradox type characteristics, where, for example, if you have a 128-bit key, but you have 2-to-the-40 messages, and you don't care which one you break, like if you're trying to rob somebody's bank account, and you see 2-to-the-40 financial transactions going by, there are ways that you can reduce the effort of the attack essentially by the number of messages you've got. So a 128-bit key where you had 2-to-the-40 messages might require, you know, 2-to-the-88 type computational effort in order to break. You can also further reduce that using some time memory trade-offs. There's a paper written by Hellman years ago about that. So I see 128 bits as actually marginal and would like to see 256 bits as a place where no matter how badly you screw up your protocol, unless you compromise the key directly, you'll be okay. Yes?
Yeah, Paul, you mentioned in the first part of the talk, you said that the algorithm that you use to do the decryption was somewhat non-intuitive. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, okay. Well, there's the problem we're trying to do here, the question is why the design was non-intuitive about the design. What we wanted to do to make this thing as flexible as possible is to work on two separate ciphertexts and only have the search units halted if both pass the criteria that we've supplied to it. So in order to make that work, you want to decrypt one, then based on the results of that, decide whether to increment your key or try the second one. So you end up with a fairly complicated state machine if you try one. You actually then try the next key in the first one. If it was a match previously, you sort of back up and try the second thing. So the whole state machine is running through probably a dozen or so different types of states as it goes. The reason for that is we want to keep, in the normal case where all you're seeing is wrong keys, you want to keep the desk search unit saturated running on the first ciphertext continually. Yeah? Question is how we divided the key space between chips. Because this project was designed to be sort of as simple as possible, chip had to work the first time, didn't want to have any problems, we went for just the simplest approach, really. And that was to have each search unit fix the top 24 bits of the key. The low 32 bits is just incremented each time. The PC control of the system doles out chunks of 2-to-the-32 keys to individual search units and then checks when they finished. Simple and very effective. Yes?
Suppose we know that we're looking for an ASCII text message, and, you know, we go through the keys. Is it not possible to find an incorrect key that would generate an incorrect readable or ASCII message?
Yes. The question is whether there could be some wrong keys that would produce, for example, ASCII messages. What will happen then is the search unit that's running along and finds one of those will stop. The host PC will pull the key out, and then the software in that PC, or the person watching the machine, or what have you, is responsible for deciding whether or not that key is actually the right one. So if it's a false positive, the PC will make that decision. For example, if you know it should be a word, and you see X, Q, Z, Z, Y, and there you
go. Question
is whether you'd see a message that was wrong and might look appropriate. There, if you have 56 bits of redundancy in the message, that's about the point. Well, if you have significantly more than 56 bits of redundancy in your message, the probability that you see a false positive that looked human readable is, or that made sense is so small that you don't worry about it. So this is all sort of a statistical type thing. It's conceivable, but if the probability is 1 in, you know, 2 to the minus 100, or 2 to the 100, you just don't care about it. Yeah? Question is whether we found a backdoor. The key length, it doesn't really qualify as a backdoor because it's sitting there and staring at anybody who looks at the way the algorithm is designed. At this point, there are still no known backdoors in DES, and I think there's been enough research that I can say fairly comfortably that there are not any. If NSA is going to be breaking that to DES, I think it's fairly clear that building a DES key search machine is the way that they would do it. Yes?
Yeah, have you considered running the rest of the key space to look for collisions?
What sort of collisions? Between
the existing key that you found and anything else that might be close or
distant in the key space. Just from a question is whether we look for collisions in the dead key space. Due to the structure of the algorithm design, it's still given there won't be any. There is the complementation property in DES where if you invert the input message, you invert the key, you invert the output. But aside from that, there could there shouldn't be any. Yes?
What type of groups have shown the most interest in your machine?
The question is who's shown interest in the machine. You know, there's actually been no statements from the NSA at all, which is interesting. It's a project that we've done with. There's been mostly just interest from people that are using DES. Some have been told from quote authorities that DES was good, and, you know, the standard is strong, is what you should use. A lot of interest from people who proposed right from the beginning, and people like Marty Hellman who said that the DES key length is too short when DES first came out, were somewhat ridiculed, and this machine, they're quite interested in seeing this machine shows that they were right. Yeah.
Well, do you have any speculation as to why the NSA hasn't shown any interest in it?
One of the guys who spotted it, Fed, you could probably ask the question better than I can.
Speculation.
I think NSA has known for a long time these things can be built. I suspect we built it probably a lot cheaper than they can. But aside from that, I don't think there's too much that should be a surprise to them out of this. Yes? Any good question? What is an S-box coincidence? I mean, there are... The S-box is a... have been analyzed by a lot of people. They have. We weren't looking for them in this particular problem. The results of Matsui's work on linear frequency analysis are probably the best analysis of interesting things in the S-box. And of course, the work by Biam and Shamir of differential frequency analysis shows that the S-boxes were designed quite well. Yes? We solved that latest challenge with it, and the machine will search keys. You know, as we were bringing it up, we tested all sorts of key searches. The machine is owned by the EFF since they arranged the financing for it. I'm not quite sure what the plans for it are. Yes. Question is whether the machine could be used to detect triple DES. Triple DES has a key space which is either two or three times as long as single DES. So if we had 72 quadrillion of these machines, we'd be able to search triple DES in 2.5 days. Unfortunately, that would make the power consumption a little bit larger than I would like to have in any sort of... But no, triple DES is not susceptible to brute force attack. Question is, what encryption algorithm would I use to encrypt my files? If you're building a system, you should use triple DES unless you have a good reason to use something else. Don't design your own ciphers if you're expecting other people to use them. That's something that you shouldn't do until you've got a lot of research background, unless you're doing it for fun. But triple DES is the most solid and well-understood algorithm. Things like Blowfish, RC4, if you're careful with how your keying is being done, those algorithms are also perfectly okay to use. DES is not terribly fast, so that's the one reason that people often use other ciphers. The DES-X instruction is also okay, but triple DES is definitely preferable. Yes?
To take advantage of any of the shortcuts to discover the software brute forcing in the hardware design,
the question was
go through full DES test.
the question is whether we used any of the shortcuts that were available. The answer is that no, because we, first of all, doing that would have increased the complexity of the chip and increased the probability that the chips wouldn't have worked the first time through. The other thing is that DIMM is very, very efficient in hardware. So to have, for example, the permutations there simply uses wiring resources which are available in abundance on a chip. So if you look at the design in the book, you'll see that we were very wasteful with wires in a sense. We did things that would be very impractical in software because they were cheap in hardware. So the optimizations are fairly different. DES was designed for hardware, and it's very good in hardware, so you don't really need that type of software hack to make it efficient. Adam? Question Matt's challenge. Matt Lay proposed the challenge of trying to find a DES message which has a characteristic that for the input is a single byte repeated, and the output is a perhaps different byte repeated. And we've got at least one of those that's been searched. I'm not sure if that's been officially announced yet, but the effort required to that is order 2 to 56 search, as opposed to a regular brute force, which is order 2 to 55. But the machine has a special little extra logic bit that is necessary for that challenge that you'll see if you look in the book. The problem there is to check whether your plain text is one byte repeated over and over again. You can't do it with ordinary plain text vectors, so there's an extra XOR step that you can do there. Sorry? Any last questions? One more. A question is whether heat was a problem, and actually it was. That was one of the things where after the chips came back, it was sort of like, you know, oh crap, these things are taking like 4 watts and they're going to all burn up. So what we did is we dropped the voltage down. We expected the ASICs to run at 5 volts, but CMOS can run anywhere from, Ben's our real good hardware guy, but 2 volts on up to about 5 maybe. We actually ended up running about 3.3, 3.5 volts. At that voltage, the chips take a couple of watts. So when you've got 1,800 chips, that's about 3,000 some watts. The room gets pretty hot, but if you've got a big fan and maybe an air conditioner, it's fine. There's some other work that we've done that you guys might also find interesting. I don't have time to talk about it today, but something called differential power analysis. It's a technique of observing statistical information in the power consumption of crypto systems and inferring the keys from that. At this point, there are no cryptographic smart cards that we're aware of that are able to resist this type of attack. So there's a huge number of systems that are susceptible to it. It's also cryptographically fairly interesting. Oh, that's the picture of the machine. I'm holding a board here from it. You can see there's 32 ASICs on each side. They're spaced out so that there aren't ASICs on each. The gaps between the ASICs have chips on the other side for cooling reasons. Going forward again, here's the whole machine. There are something like 5 or so boards in each of these chassis, which contain they're old Sun 2 cases, I think, plus a large pair of diodes used to drop the 5-volt power supply down to 3.3 volts. A hack, but, you know, it works, and that's when you're building. And here's one of the chips. The machine's name is Deep Crack. Because the air comes up from the bottom, is why the chassis is on bricks. So if you put it down, then air can't get in. Oh yeah, $250,000 for a machine like this is, you know, where you use duct tape instead of nice metal brackets and things. But thanks a lot. I will take questions in the back afterwards if anybody's interested. I've got also some, you know, CPA information that if anybody's playing around with smart cards and wants to talk, I'll tell you what I can about that. So I will be in the back. Thanks very much. More information about this, a lot of the other projects we've done, is academic information, links to papers on our website, www.cryptography.com, pretty easy to remember. So if you're interested, just look at that.